Hi, welcome. This is Dave. I'm in a totally new setting, so it took me a little bit to figure out my new codes to dial in. How are you?
Hi, Dave.
Welcome.
Well, let's begin. Malia.
Welcome. How are you?
I'm good, thanks.
Well, let's begin with wins and progress notes.
Is there anybody else besides me?
There are some lurkers, but you go ahead.
Oh, okay. Wins and progress. Well, I sent you the roadmap. That was
yes,
that was
absolutely.
Fun. Yeah,
absolutely.
And so that.
And
was
I look
good.
Forward to going over that.
Yeah. So, yeah.
And I'm glad you found it beneficial. I was very impressed with it, and I think it'll be an interesting exercise for all of us to engage.
Right. Well, yeah, well, I look forward to talking about it. So, okay, anything else?
Anything else for you?
Well, let's see. Well, I've been working with some clients, and there's always tons of questions around that, but it's going well. It feels like it's going well. Yeah. So, I'm kind of curious a little bit about resistance when somebody's resistant to change and how to, they're either not contacting you back to schedule the next appointments or you feel.
Okay, are there things that you want to deal with about that? In addition to the roadmap that you want to present or in the context of
oh,
that?
No, not particularly. I just thought, you were just asking about wins and advances and stuff. So,
well, I think it's an important aspect to discuss. If you want to wrap that into your presentation roadmap, we can do that. And then if there are additional things that we don't cover, let's address that at that point then.
Yeah. Well, let's just see how it goes. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Super.
Okay.
We also have a new member. Is Mary Beth here?
Yes, sir. I'm here.
Welcome. Would you introduce yourself to the group? First of all, let me ask, how have you done in terms of catching up with the recorded seminars, and where are you with that?
Well, actually, I did find them, and I have been listening to them and trying to catch up as quickly as I could. But I had sent you an email earlier. I found myself being so excited and into them that I've been listening to certain ones over and over, and so I haven't completely caught up to where we are.
Okay, that's fine.
But I will. I expect to do that real soon.
It's your own timetable and the dosing and timing, and that's why they're recorded, so that anybody can go back over them or listen to some aspect or something that didn't quite make sense to see if it might happen to make sense the next time around. So great. Would you introduce yourself and let us know a bit about you and how you came to this point and what you'd like to get out of our work together collaboratively?
Sure. Actually, I graduated from high school in 1985, so not to date myself, but there's some history behind that. When I was in high school, I knew that when I graduated, I really wanted to pursue a psychology degree. And so out of high school, I enrolled in college as a psych major and started progressing down that road. And then life just kind of, I like to say, or I seem to always be saying, life just kind of happened. And I wasn't really driving the train at the time. And subsequently, due to some decisions that I made and things that I did, a divorce, two kids, and 24 years later now, plus, I've been in a successful project management position for a leading IT company in San Antonio, Texas. So I've had some what I would consider to be a very successful career over the past many years, but not necessarily one that I chose. I kind of feel like it chose me in a way. So a few years ago, I had the opportunity, a friend of mine asked me what would you do if you knew that you could do it and not fail? And I couldn't answer the question right away, and so that bothered me.
That's a good question.
And so ultimately I ended up sitting down and did a little bit of the self-reflection type stuff and thought to myself, you know, I'd really like to get back to what I originally wanted to do, although I thought pursuing a psychology degree at this point in my life, you know, it might be a little late and time-consuming, and it might not happen as quick as what I would want it to do if I chose to go down that path. So life coaching came up. And the ironic thing about this whole thing is that while I was listening to the recorded sessions, I realized that Jennifer Powers is in this class, and she was my mentor coach.
Oh, all right. Excellent.
Yeah, I was really excited to hear that.
Oh, great.
But at any rate, I took my class a few years ago and became certified, and then going about the process of trying to build up my client base, I had chosen a particular niche, I think, and I kept thinking, well, maybe that's too focused, and maybe I should, you know, look at other things, and I don't know, the whole self-doubt thing kind of came into play, and then I happened to go back to the CTA website and saw the description about this particular class, and I was thinking, that's what I want to do. I want to get to the point to where I help others recognize what their life has been to this point and what their role in that has been. And in identifying that, I kind of came to my own impasse of realizing my life is not, you know, where I would like it to be. And so what I'm really expecting is that through this particular course of trying to be trained to help others, I'm going to ultimately end up helping myself. At least I believe so. And so that's what I'm trying to achieve.
Okay, well, excellent. Excellent. What was your niche?
My niche is actually helping parents of special needs children. And I kind of explained in my email to you a little bit, I alluded to the fact I am like a huge idea generator. I just have idea after idea after idea, and I'm always coming up short on execution of the idea. And I'm really trying to go down the path of why that is, but I think I'm getting there, and I'm really not necessarily liking what my answers are, but
Your specific niche in coaching has been what?
It's helping parents of special needs children.
Okay. Okay, great. Is that further refined to any specific special needs?
Actually, it wasn't originally, although I seem to, ironically enough, after I got my certification and I started coming across people that I had already been communicating with and just didn't know that they had special needs children as part of their life, when I was telling them about what I was doing, invariably each of them, whom I already knew, started telling me about autistic children that they have as family members. So, so autism seems to have taken a really big step forward there. And it wasn't really just because I chose anything. Again, it just seems that, I guess to a certain extent, I'm a believer in signs. And you know, I think God speaks to me in different ways. But a lot of times I ignore the signs, and I just wanted to try to, you know, be sensitive to what was happening. And it seemed to always be happening that way.
I think that can be a huge contribution. My daughter is a psychologist in Boston, and her entire practice is devoted to Asperger kids and their parents, and she has a whole 12-person team and works with coaches as well as teachers and counselors to help with, you know, has a camp and a school. So, there is a great deal of need, I think, that you have a resource and a way to address that can be really huge. So I think you've got a really special niche, and you may expand or change that on the basis of this work, but I think you have, you know, and you certainly can have more than one niche. You get one established and move on to the next one and develop one at a time. So thanks very, very much. That's great.
Sure.
Who else wants to check in and bring us up to date? Is Jennifer here?
I'm here, Dave.
Welcome.
Hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Yeah.
You have an old student, as you hear.
I do. Can I get her name? Because I know the voice and I know the niche. I just can't place the name.
Mary Beth Stolte.
Oh, Mary Beth.
Who's just down the road a piece here in Texas. I'm in Houston, and she's in San Antonio.
Well, hi, Mary Beth.
Hey, Jennifer.
Great. What fun. I'm here, yeah, and let's see. Lots of good things have been happening, and I'm just still continuing to love the material and eager to get into today's story. And because, you know, I was the only one that put it all out there last time, so I'm excited to work on this next one.
That's great. Any updates for you, Jennifer?
Let's see. Well, I am continuing to unfold my own story as I work with my clients on helping them. And I find myself, I'm going to keep the comments or the updates more pertinent to this classwork, if that's okay, Dave.
Absolutely. Okay.
Yeah. Super. So I find myself really almost automatically now referring to the story and helping the client identify the story more so than I ever did before, and I can't tell you what a change that is. It's kind of like I have my own little personal artillery in my pocket that I can pull out, and it always is applicable. And so I'm really grateful for that. So I find myself more and more using that in my sessions and in the masterminds that I run with my other clients. So it's good. It's good stuff.
That's great. Super.
Yeah,
well, thanks for the update. Who else? Updates, wins, progress notes. Is Tisha here? What about Terry Finney or Terry Holmes?
I'm here. It's Terry Finney.
Welcome. Hi. How are you?
I'm well. First of all, I want to let you know there's 5 feet of snow in Steamboat.
Wow. I'm excited.
Yeah.
Okay.
The mountain doesn't open for another week, but there's 5 feet of snow, so that's very exciting for us.
That's very exciting. I have my reservations in March, so I know it'll hold.
Oh, well, so you have to get in touch with me before then. I can tell you all the secrets of.
Okay. Great.
Where to go.
So what's going on for you?
You know what? I actually, it's an interesting week. I've been working really diligently on visualizing and goals, and this week have had some bizarre money stuff happen to me that's put me in a huge hole, and bad money stuff never happens to me, ever. It's always under control.
Huh.
So, yeah, not sure what that's about, but it seems like the more I vision and work on goals, it's having a backwards result for me.
Uh-huh. Hmm.
Yeah, not sure what that's about.
Curious.
Yeah.
Well, do you have a plan to address it?
I do have a plan. I have a plan, and I'm working the plan, and I suspect that in a couple of weeks it'll all be fine. But it's just it's a very bizarre set of circumstances, and just totally unexpected. So I'm trying to make sense of that.
Yeah. Well, if there's anything that you want to share with us, feel free to. I understand it's very personal, though, and if there's any way that we as a group can be of help, let us know.
Thanks. I appreciate that.
Okay. Others who want to check in.
I'm here. This is Terry Holmes.
Welcome. How are you? What's going on?
I'm doing well. Not a lot going on. I'm just looking at preparing my roadmap for next week's session. I should have that hopefully available by the middle of the week.
Okay. Great. I will explain why I'm having to do this in just a moment. I need to put my headset down and grab a couple of things that I don't have, and it will totally make sense in a moment. So give me 1 minute and carry on amongst yourselves. Excuse me. Okay, I'm back. Sorry for the interruption. I am spending the month of November in an old Creole cottage in the French Quarter in New Orleans finishing a book. So I am operating totally in a different way for this month, and I didn't gather all the things I needed to gather for this class as I thought I did. So this has been a very special and interesting experience for me. I'm having a great time, and it really emphasizes how we can do this work anywhere in the world. I'm doing still, it's kind of a working sabbatical. I'm doing everything that I usually do in terms of training and classes and clients. It's just that the rest of the time I'm here working on a book and having just a terrific time with a very unique setting. So it's a really interesting experience. So, Lolly, are you ready to talk about your roadmap? Would you like to present it to us?
Hi, Dave. Just had to unmute.
Okay, great.
Yeah. So, okay. So let's see. I forgot. I thought it was very cute how was it Terry said she was interested, having been on the spot last week, that she was interested in somebody else being on the spot. So here I am. But I don't remember how the process was. Do you want me to just basically kind of go through what?
Yeah, just present that to us, and then
sure.
You know, we will respond or have any questions or discuss
okay.
it. And if there's anything you'd like us to focus on or highlight or discuss, let us know. But then if you want to lead any discussion about it, but just
okay.
present it
great.
as you would
great.
Like.
Yeah, well, this whole idea of kind of that you create your own story and you can rewrite it has really intrigued me from the very beginning. And so, of course, I started with all kinds of thoughts on what to pick, because there are in all our lives a lot of areas that we could work on a new story on, for sure. So, but the thing that's in the forefront for me right now is kind of rebooting my coaching practice. I had a coaching practice, and I wasn't feeling incredibly successful for a variety of reasons, mainly in the marketing. I felt fine when I was working with clients for the most part, but there was still something missing. And then I started to proceed with some marketing and was met with obstacles. And I was interested in, was it the other Terry? I can't remember, keep track of everybody's names. I was talking about kind of how all of a sudden with visualizing all these things are starting to happen. And I just read a quote, this is a little sidebar, in one of my coaching books. I can't remember maybe it was in your workbook, Dave, where the coach responded to the client by saying, well, if you weren't moving forward, you wouldn't be having any obstacles. So that was an interesting way of looking at when blocks get in your way.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what I was experiencing constantly. I felt that there were blocks in my way. I was marketing in the ways which back then, this was not quite 10 years ago, there wasn't the social media avenues to put oneself out there. So you had to kind of do the networking and the try to create venues for workshops and that kind of thing. And it just wasn't working. So then I sort of reassessed and said, well, you know, what do I really like to do? And so I started to explore sort of doing more training in development and got certified in assessment tools and, you know, wanted to get into more group work than individual coaching. And I kind of had the same issues with the marketing and not quite being able to get off my feet. And then went into teaching and had, in a funny way, a similar story. It was good. It was fine. I knew I was sort of in the right dimension. And yet it just didn't seem to have, it just didn't have wings. It just couldn't seem to take off. And so that's my old story. And then I've just recently come back to wanting to coach and have perhaps and have a different way of doing it, a more life coaching approach than what I had been doing. And I'm really finding it, I'm feeling extremely, inspired by it and connected, and more so than in anything I had been trying to do. But I've got the old story of the marketing and putting myself out there and having, I should say I had the old story. the feeling, the lack of self-confidence of putting myself out there. And so for me, it's a really good, as I rewrote the story, I could really feel a shift for me. I was a little surprised, actually, because reading somebody else's story, you're just reading it. You don't know whether, you don't experience their shift necessarily.
Can I interrupt you to ask you to focus, if you would, on the roadmap itself and what you've come
right
to, so that we'll have
okay
time to
discuss
it just a bit.
Well, I'm sort of yeah, so here I recognize kind of that I was essentially the story is about my business development and my coaching practice, and I had this story where I felt I was not capable of gaining the self-confidence and that I needed to do the marketing that I needed to do. And so, now, my new story is to have kind of a realistic perspective that I have the capabilities to be a successful coach, and to, and also I now have the knowledge that I have a lot more opportunities for marketing that were not available before, and I have a much stronger support system now that also can help me, mentor me and give me the guidance in order to help me move forward. So, and I am moving forward with a much more confident self-confidence and concept in terms of developing my practice as a coach. So let's see, what else?
Would you highlight a little bit how you, when you decided, you looked at deciding what to change about realistic perspective of capabilities, and how you let go of this embarrassed self-concept? How did you actually do that? What was your dialogue or your process? Because I think that's really interesting.
The dialogue, and yeah, that's a great question, actually. The dialogue was that I actually had an image of myself in situations where I would be, for starters, just simply telling people that I know, just my network of friends, and saying, I'm back to doing this, I'm working on developing this business. And so I would actually create an image of myself doing that. And then I would do it. I actually found myself saying, put it out there. And see how what comes back to you. And I know, and as of course, it, that in and of itself started to increase more self-confidence in myself as I found people. And I would put myself, whenever I could put, insert this, that I am developing my coaching business, whenever I could insert that statement, I would do it. Whenever I could say, I would say, gee, I can't make that meeting because I have a 2 p.m. phone call. It's 2 p.m. in California for my coaching practice. Or I'd say I've got clients. So I would create opportunities where I would put myself out there and announce myself as developing my coaching practice. And so that was a shift, was actually to sort of visualize it, see the opportunities when they arose, and then take action and actually do it. And
I see where you have a specific networking and marketing plan with a timeline and target dates and a strategy of doing that. That sounds like it's very useful. And would you expand just a little bit on your last step about how you incorporated these changes into your identity, into the fundamental model of how and who you are as you proceed? How did you find that process?
I found them self-fulfilling in a certain way, as in self-fulfilling prophecy. I found that the more I took the steps, the more the identity became stronger. And so, you know, it's been baby steps, but I'm seeing them increase much more, and the more steps I'm taking, the more ideas I have come up with for other ways to continue to expand on the marketing. I mean, the thing that I'm in a situation where I am in a network of people. I'm in Silicon Valley, and so I have access to an enormous network just of people who are in business here or in entrepreneurial ventures, and that alone, just personal network, is a huge potential for my marketing. Yeah. But I had to get over the hump of feeling self-confident that somebody wouldn't look at me and say, "Are you kidding? What can you do?"
And remember, confidence is a state of mind. So that is
state of mind.
You can address in terms of creating your own story and really generating that state of mind, because it's,
yes,
it's something you can condition yourself to do, and specifically and strategically do by regulating your state of mind.
Right. And there is something about the exercise of writing it down that while I was writing it, that actually changed my state of mind. That was what was interesting for me, was that
there's been a study of people who write down things. In fact, USA Today did a very extensive study of people who make New Year's resolutions, and of people who make New Year's resolutions and say them, 4% accomplish them. People who write them down, 44%. Follow through and accomplish them. So a tenfold difference just in writing it down. There's something about making it real and committing.
It's something
it
about, yeah. Yeah, because the words, you know, they're coming out of you, or they came out of me, and so therefore there's a certain belief. If it comes out of you and you put it down in paper, then that must mean that there's something in you that actually really truly believes that. And there was it was a really interesting shift for me. It was a very interesting exercise, actually, to do.
Well, let me ask if there are others who have questions or comments about the roadmap that we just heard from Lalia. anything anyone wants to add or ask. Well, thank you very much for presenting that. I think I'm glad it was a useful exercise for you, and I think you brought it together in a meaningful way, and it'll be interesting to see as a progress note down the pike how this evolves, because this is really a foundation and an ongoing process, and once this process is internalized, then it continues and really kind of takes on a life of its own. So thank you very, very much for doing that.
Yes, thank you, Dave.
Absolutely.
And everybody.
I want to keep the line open so you can add or ask anything as we talk a little bit. I want to in this session bring together what we've discussed about guiding change and facilitating growth, and talk some about advancing the plot. And beginning next session, we'll talk about niche applications. Life stories change usually in one of three ways: when existing solutions no longer work, when the situation changes, or if possibilities actually require new approaches. And sometimes we just come to the end of a story cycle and recognize that we don't exactly have a new one waiting to step into. It's been said that the end of an era is when all its basic illusions have ended. So how do you make sense of new information that doesn't fit into an existing framework? Usually someone ignores it until they no longer can. As alchemists, we help people see possibility to engage a transformative process. I want to talk about three types of empathy, because I think that really having a way of thinking about this in a more specific way can be helpful and instructive in our listening and in our collaboration with people. Empathy, as you know, is a listening perspective inside the experience of someone else. It's our ability to place one foot in the shoe of another to resonate with someone else's experience, including how that person thinks, feels, constructs meaning, and communicates. In other words, to know as much as possible about their subjective reality and to not get lost there, to keep one foot in our shoe. So as we talk about and read about how we read and respond to others' experiences, let's consider the three kinds of empathy. One is cognitive empathy. That's really to know the perspective of another person, what the person might be thinking. This can help in negotiation, finding a way to motivate people, and it can help in coaching in certain ways. A study at the University of Birmingham found that managers who were good at taking another's perspective, cognitive empathy, were able to help workers achieve better efforts. Now, the downside with only cognitive empathy, it can result in cold calculation, understanding another's point of view, but without taking emotions into account, kind of like informed detachment. And con artists are really good at cognitive empathy. A second is emotional empathy. When you can sense what other people experience as though their emotions were contagious, this emotional contagion occurs largely because of mirror neurons in the brain, a complex set of neural response patterns that fire when we sense another's emotional state. We sense the echo of another's experience in our minds and bodies. This emotional empathy attunes us to another person's emotional world, and it's immensely valuable in coaching. And another aspect of that, and this is something I'm writing about now in terms of synchronicities, is the reading of energy fields of another person. Now, the downside of emotional empathy is, as a coach, we may have some difficulty managing our own emotions if they're powerful and are distressing enough. And we also have to protect ourselves from depletion, from psychological exhaustion, especially if you're a feeler, even more so if you're an intuitive empath. If you haven't done this, I would suggest that you Google intuitive empath, E-M-P-A-T-H, and just look at one of the first two or three articles that you see and read a little bit about it and see if this is an accurate description of yourself. My bet is that it is, because it is for all of us to be doing what we're doing, but especially notice what you have to do to protect yourself when there's a toxic source or when people really are a negative energy source, that you have to protect yourself from people and from people who emotionally drain you. And just look at ways or strategies of protecting yourself. An example of emotional empathy in terms of the downside. It was my own experience during Hurricane Katrina. We witnessed high-level leaders being curiously detached despite abundant evidence that they needed to take action. I saw on television the suffering and misery that people in New Orleans experienced. My own response, since I did some of my medical training in New Orleans, was, I know those people. I trained some of them. The guy wading through the water carrying his baby, I could have delivered him when he was born. So that's the downside, to get way over-involved. Too little involvement, on the other hand, could be indifference. The balance and informed caring that doesn't get in the way of the client having all of his or her own experience and working with it. So empathy, then, is not an end in itself. It's a means to a better end. Now, a footnote here is when someone carefully crafts a speech or tells a story, the art is to allow the emotional response to reside in the listener or the reader, and the same for our clients. Rather than expressing it ourselves or telling someone how they should respond, we facilitate the client or the listener or the reader to have their own experiences. We can learn from the poets who give it to the reader or listener to experience themselves. And a third type is compassionate empathy, the resonance with another person, the experience and knowledge that we're all connected. An example of a balance here is staying cool in a crisis and then allowing ourselves to become more active in order to help. Now, a judgment call in compassionate empathy is to recognize where we can and where we can't be effective in doing something so that we put all of our energy into doing what we can be effective in doing. Now, a couple of caveats of empathy. If you move into abstraction, it's less real. And this is something that we can hear with our clients at times. If they're having difficulty with something, they stay at the level of abstract or move into it, so we know they may be having difficulty with some specific feeling that they're moving away from. There's a drop-off of empathy as you move further away from the real experience of people. For example, someone may feel more empathy for a puppy with a hurt paw than for a person without health insurance. The person without health insurance is a statistic, one among 51 million others. Now, let's talk a little bit about mind maps, the brain story. The brain connections, or mind maps, influence the reality that we see. The mind map is the brain's story. A paradigm, which is roughly synonymous with a mind map, is a model. It's a theory or a frame of reference. It's simply the way we see the world. What we perceive, how we understand, how we interpret, is our individual paradigm, our map. The paradigm is the map that explains the territory. It's not the territory itself. With the right map, planning and strategy can make a significant difference. And this is something I think we don't quite talk enough about in coaching, is to be sure our client has the right map, the right paradigm to approach an issue or to plan strategically. And I'll give you an example of that in a moment. Each of us has a number of maps or paradigms in our head, our storylines. We're often unaware of having them, assuming that we just see things the way they are. These paradigms, the way we see things, then determine how we structure meaning and how we think and behave. So they become very, very important in that way. We originally construct beliefs to make sense of our experiences in the world. The beliefs then confirm our models of the world. They become predictors. They become, without even having to consciously decide, our way of being effective. A map really reduces the size and complexity of a territory. With this understanding, we can be really effective in taking action. So rather than each situation being overwhelming or a new experience where we have to figure it out all over again, our attention shifts to an organizing frame of reference, the mind map. We can help a client choose the most effective mind map. We relate it to something we know, which immediately suggests action options. Now, a danger is that we place the new into the container of the old, which could prevent new learning. Now, this is kind of an example. I had an experience recently that had an impact on me. Right after, it was a very few years ago, right after a hurricane hit Houston, we were without power for almost a couple of weeks. So all the food stuff had to be restocked. Now, I hate grocery stores. I can never find stuff. And if I do, it's hard for me to find it back the next time. I just can't figure out the organizational scheme. The principles, of course, I think it should all be alphabetical. So I'm always asking somebody to guide me. I ask a really nice lady employee where the organic maple syrup was. She smiled and said, all the sticky stuff is on aisle 3. And I said, you know, that's the nicest thing anybody has ever said to me in a grocery store. That's a map. I'll never forget that. Now, a mind map simply allows us not to have to discover all over again each time what something means or its purpose or how to deal with it. It's like going the same route to work each day so we don't have to think about it and can think about other things or read an audiobook. You don't have to relearn the route every time. Beliefs become an effective way to use previous experiences as a map to navigate. Now, UCLA research professor Marilyn Kowalski found that 97% of kindergartners think out of the box, while by age 30, only 3% of people do. Now, kindergartners don't plan to think of ways outside the box. They simply haven't constructed a box yet. The box is a personal construction, a belief system that's actively created, both consciously and unconsciously, to shape both perception and processing. At times, a way to think outside the box is simply to suspend judgment and approach something with a beginner's mind. It opens the door to possibilities. And one of our uniquely human qualities is self-awareness, the ability to reflect on how we think and what we do. Having this ability, we can learn from both our own experiences and from those of others. This is how we can create a new story. We are not our old story. We created our old story. We are not our habits or our thoughts. We can think about these things, reflect on them, examine our paradigms to see if they serve us well. Now, a dilemma means having two or more mental maps in conflict. So the work of coaching here involves, at first, at a macroscopic level, selecting the mental map that's most productive for a given task, or developing a new meta map, a new map, if one doesn't exist. An example, as we've talked before, to correctly read the anxiety or the uncertainty of a new endeavor as validation of moving ahead beyond a comfort zone, rather than in an old model as a signpost to danger, better head for cover. And at a microscopic level, awareness of the choices of this moment and picking the best one. Now, here's an example of that and how the right mindset is important. If you label something wrong, you're going to write the wrong story. You'll use the wrong map. For example, if you feel bad saying no to someone and label the feeling as guilt, you're going to be using a different map than if you see no as setting an appropriate boundary. No means no. You have priorities. You're taking care of yourself. And this is not one of the priorities. Different ways of viewing things boots up an entirely different mindset. And you're in different directions depending on how you perceive it. Now, here's an example of a conflicting mindset. A client of mine, an attorney, was asked by her dad, I'd like you to be the executor of my estate. His daughter, my client, said, well, sure, Dad. First, I'll need to know some basic things about your property and your wishes. He said, well, that's none of your business. Now, remember that the map is not the territory. That is, beliefs are not reality, at least not consensual reality. Beliefs are only the negotiations we construct to deal with the subjective realities that we each experience. So we need to recognize that we each create our own stories and need to take ownership of those stories to assess what needs to change or be enhanced or be ignored. Now, first we identify the particular patterns we use. Then we look at the specific ways that we maintain these beliefs. Now, I heard the story of an old codger describe his version of looking for patterns. If one person tells you you're a horse, they're crazy. If three people tell you you're a horse, conspiracy. If 10 people tell you you're a horse, time to buy a saddle. Now, just as you have to know the steps in order to dance, you have to know the beliefs that construct the story. And remember, beliefs drive behaviors. Beliefs determine the experiences and results of what we do. Because people always make their beliefs come true. Remember the two anthropologists. If you believe no one will love you, you'll interpret behavior and perceive responses in that way and act so that you won't be lovable or will block intimacy. You'll act in such a way to teach people exactly how to respond to you. And this is where we really earn our money in coaching, is when someone recreates a process with us, an attachment pattern, for example, and they're showing us in vivo exactly what it's like to be them so that we can teach them and collaborate with them about revising something as fundamental as their attachment patterns with important others. Beliefs are directives to your mind to make something happen in your life. A belief is the mind's command to the brain. One very simple way to get someone to tell you a belief, to make it conscious, is to simply say, well, yeah, but how do you really know that? And then they'll tell you their belief, how they believe they really know. One way to determine core beliefs is to assess the results you're getting in your life, kind of like the Dr. Phil question of how's that working for you. Outcome is not measured by intention, but by results. One of the 48 laws of power, if any of you are familiar with that book by Robert Greene, is that intention does not matter, only results. Examine the results in each of these different domains or these storylines of your life: financial, career, relationship, personal. Consider that if someone's getting a better result, they have a different, better, or more empowering belief. With the same belief, you'll continue to have the same results. If you change your belief, you can have different results. The most common source of resistance is to continue to hold an old belief and expect new results. Now, I want to talk about comfort zones, but I want to pause. Are there any questions or comments or additions that any of you have so far? Or anything you'd like to talk a little bit more about? Okay, well, don't hesitate if you do. Now, let's revisit the concept of comfort zone, because this relates to the question about resistance in coaching. And every client you see will have, at various points in their work with you, different kinds of resistance. But each will experience resistance in some way, simply because that's the way their minds and their brains are wired. A comfort zone is a familiar pattern of behavior. It's a gradual process, but once established, resists change. Think of a comfort zone like your home thermostat. If the temperature increases or decreases, it signals an adjustment to return to the set point, the comfort zone. Our minds and brains both contribute. We even have a comfort zone with things that we do every day, from what we eat to our weight. We return to the familiar even when we don't like it or when it's uncomfortable. A comfort zone is predictable and automatic. We know the outcome. Think about how subtle a comfort zone can be in determining choices. What you eat, the difficulty of starting a new exercise program. Now, comfort zones work really great because it can make certain things that you do, something you don't even have to think about, and you don't have to put any energy into it. I know every morning what I'm going to have for breakfast. I don't have to think about it. I don't have to plan it, other than just to be sure I'm good to go. I'm going to have grapefruit, and I'm going to have a bran muffin every morning. Slam dunk. I know exactly what I don't have to spend any time doing it. So comfort zones can work very well. A comfort zone can be a behavior pattern, such as self-effacing jokes, or a state of mind, such as responding angrily to certain situations. It can be the repeated role you play in a relationship, or procrastination of lifestyle changes you need to make. Now, a comfort zone can manifest in certain patterns, storylines, or in recurring characters. Working under pressure, waiting until the last minute, creating crises, all can be comfort zones. And you probably know people who become addicted to that last flourish of activity to meet a deadline and really thrive on the stimulation and the neurochemical charge they get out of barely finishing that deadline, but the excitement of it. Even though it may be negative excitement, it's still a neurochemically induced charge to repeat the same pattern. Another example, someone can be an underdog and succeed against all odds. This can become a comfort zone of behavior in which the same pattern is repeated over and over, faster and faster, so that escalating success is the repeated comfort zone. Now, here's one more example of a comfort zone in action. Most lottery winners manage to spend or give away their newfound winnings to return to their previous situation. In the U.S., of all lottery winners, $3 million and over, 80% have filed bankruptcy within the first 5 years. Their money changed, but their mindsets didn't. So much money moved them from their comfort zone, and they simply ended up returning to it. And remember, a habit is not a definition. It's a choice that gets repeated. In the beginning, departure from a comfort zone feels, by definition, uncomfortable. It's a rupture of continuity. Remember this with each client. Remember to resonate with their experience of uncertainty, of trepidation, of anxiety, as they move from a comfort zone, as they try out something different. Empathically resonate with them, and then help them understand what they're experiencing by providing a new model that this is validation that they're moving ahead into new territory beyond where they're familiar, so that they don't interpret it in an old way of danger, better head for cover, or it's my gut telling me this is not quite right for me. My gut's telling me that I'm uncomfortable, so that means that this isn't the right choice for me. There are intuitive reads, but this move from a comfort zone is not that, and it can be mistaken for that. The choices we tend to make usually are from our comfort zone, but a comfort zone can trade passion for predictability, creativity for continuity, and the new for the familiar. So, to break out of a comfort zone, your performance, even the money you make, operates in a similar way. If people get more successful, they feel vaguely uncomfortable, just different. If the results go outside their self-image, it can cue that internal thermostat to return to the comfort zone. This is an example I heard Jack Canfield tell about his stepdad. Jack's stepdad, this was back in the early 80s, was a regional manager for NCR. He noticed that each of his salespeople had a particular self-image of themselves as a salesperson. They kind of fell into two groups. They were either a $2,000 a month salesperson or a $3,000 a month salesperson in terms of their net commissions. If a salesperson's self-image was that he earned $3,000 a month in commissions, when he got to that figure each month, he'd kind of slack off until the next month. But if it were close to the end of the month and he'd only earned, say, $1,200 or $1,500, he'd work 16-hour days, weekends, and beat the bushes until he got to that $3,000. A comfort zone is an unconscious thermostat until it becomes conscious. then we can reprogram our minds and brains. And our brain has a mind of its own. Now, there's something in addition here I want to talk about. We've talked about getting marooned in your right brain with emotional stimulation, and the right brain can seize and hold hostage the left brain and create an imbalance because of emotion. I want to consider with you the other half of that, the way that our left brain can trump any function of our right brain, and we can get in negative thought loops. A thought loop is mentally replaying the same thoughts and reviewing the same scenarios again and again. You can't find an exit. You can't think or logic your way out of it. A thought loop drains energy and leads to no new solutions. It looks like focusing, but it's really obsessing. Think of a time when you got in a thought loop, an argument with a partner, a disappointing review, upsetting information about your child. Thought loops are being marooned in your left brain. Common precipitants include hurt, helplessness, disappointment. And a thought loop can become a repetition of, well, if I'd only done that, or this is what I should have said. Part of a thought loop includes picking things in the environment then that fit into that thought cycle. You choose the data that confirms and perpetuates your belief and the thought loop. Remember, for example, the Y2K scare, the repeated concerns and anticipation of disaster. People were storing extra food and water and supplies in anticipation of worldwide computer failure. Mark Twain said, "I've lived a long life and I've had many troubles. A few of them actually even happened." So think about also, I won't go into the detail here because we just heard a really thorough roadmap already, but think about how you can roadmap any aspect of a presentation that you hear in a client. To think about, for example, how you can roadmap and guide a client to do a roadmap on a negative thought loop and have them do exactly what each of you are doing to give them that protocol or that template and have them look at it from beginning to recognize that they're in a thought loop of worry and it's something they can't let go of and look at going through that in a stepwise way to observe the triggers that initiate a thought loop of worry. Assess how they're responding, how they would like to respond, determine the next, you know, to go through that process and see if that may be helpful to get to new experiences and then to revise their model. Let's look for a moment at something that I think is really important. I think it's important in your business as well as in working with an individual client, and that's choice architecture. We talk about that in terms of how we're helping a client step by step look at their best choice and in this moment, and that's exactly what we're focusing on in coaching, is to help a client look at the choice of this moment and then what happens next. But I want to look at a little bit bigger picture here of choice architecture. An example of choice architecture, and I'll tell you how this applies to coaching in just a moment. Think about how it may apply to your business, though. A study at a local car wash ran a promotion featuring loyalty cards. Each time a customer bought a car wash, they got a stamp on their card. And when they filled up their card with 8 stamps, they got a free car wash. Now, another group of customers, same car wash, got a loyalty card in which they needed to collect 10 stamps rather than 8 to get a free car wash. But they were given a head start when they received their cards. 2 stamps had already been added. So same objective. You get 8 stamps, you get a free car wash. The goal was the same for both. But the psychology and therefore the motivation was really different. For those who had a head start with the 2 stamps, they were already 20% of the way toward a goal rather than starting from scratch, and that affected their mindset. Several months later, the results were these. 19% of the 8-stamp customers earned a free car wash. 34% of the Head Start group earned a free car wash, almost twice as many. And this group earned their free car wash more than twice as fast, meaning they were ready to start over and spend more money sooner. So by simply the way it was structured, there was a fourfold difference in terms of response. People are motivated to be partly finished with a longer task or journey than to be just beginning even a shorter one. To motivate action would be to frame the task to help people feel they're closer to the finish line. Now, think about how we can do that with clients in terms of looking at each step they're taking, helping them see the big picture in a way that we can see better than they can, to look at how they're making progress. You know, an example would be to say, look at where you are now in dealing with that in terms of where you were just a couple of months ago. A couple of months ago, I couldn't have gotten away with saying that. We wouldn't have been able to address that in the full, clear way that we just did even a month ago. So I think it's important to really validate progress and highlight how someone is making progress step by step. And this is what I'm talking about of making that P, programming new identity, evolving a model, part of an ongoing process that we do with a client, something that we're doing all the time. Now, does that make sense, or are there any questions about that? Okay, well, let me mention a couple of other things, and then I want to save some time for discussion. One is a frame. How we frame something can change the meaning. The meaning can change our minds, and our minds can change our brains. Meaning derives from the frame we place around something, an event or situation. Your response, your perception to an experience, and the meaning that you attribute to it is a bridge between an external event and an internal state. Each meaning and each frame is yours to construct. It's not there until you create it. A couple of examples here. An original experiment was done, and this is one of the original experiments that began the whole field of behavioral economics. Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky at Princeton had subjects spin a wheel that would supposedly stop at random numbers between 1 and 100. They were then asked what percentage of African countries belong to the United Nations. For one group of subjects, the wheel was preset to stop at 10. For the second group, it was preset to stop on 65. For the group that it was preset to stop at 10, they guessed that 25% belonged to the United Nations. The second group guessed 45%. And the subjects insisted that the number on the wheel, when they were told that it was preset, had no relation to the correct answer to the question and no relation to their determination. Yet, the number the wheel stopped on had profound influence on responses. Even irrelevant information can influence judgments, which can then influence decisions. Another repeated experiment was done in which Kahneman had people write down the last digit of their Social Security number and then bid on objects. People whose ending Social Security number was between 0 and 4 bid less than half of those from 5 to 9 on the same objects. They were primed. This is called priming. They were primed by a number that they had in mind that served as a point of reference, an anchor, even though they didn't really think that it consciously did. So the way you frame the question can make a great deal of difference. Here's an example of that effect. When companies automatically enroll their employees in retirement savings plans, the employee has to opt out to not participate. In other words, to actually make a choice that says, I will not save for my future. When it's automatic, though, it's, of course, 100% by definition in the beginning, then it levels to between 86 to 94%. So most people stay in. At companies where it isn't automatic and someone has to choose to opt in, only 20% and to participate, over a fourfold difference. Now, there's one more example that will just show you the impact of this about how people are sensitive to things that shouldn't matter, but it's good to know what does matter. One group of countries in Europe has an option that people, and about half of them actually, can donate their organs unless they check a box that says they don't want to. They have to opt out, in other words, to choose not to. Their rate of organ donation, 95%. Another group of countries, someone donates only if they decide to opt in. They have to make a decision to opt in. Their rate of donation, 18%. Way over a fourfold difference there, too. So, to discern meaning, you need a context to surround it. The frame can even determine your state of mind. Now, we help clients reframe. Somebody has a setback, a disappointment, a crisis. Rather than continuing to focus on the upsetting issue or negative energy or trying to figure out reasons, we ask, what's the opportunity here? Problem to possibility. When someone completes their list of options or runs out of possibilities, we nudge. What else? The reticular activating system at the base of the brain decides what's allowed into consciousness out of all the information streaming into the brain. For example, right now, pay attention to your feet. Wiggle your toes. Move your feet back and forth on the floor. Be very aware of how your feet feel in your shoes or sandals. Now, your feet were always there. Same information was always coming in out of the millions of bits of data. But by selective attention, you became aware of this. You pay attention to whatever fits your story, the framework you use. We code our radar for possibilities, and we see then what our radar is coded for and don't see the things that our radar is not coded for. For example, part of your story is your self-image. If someone says something really nice to you and you don't believe it, it won't register. It'll be disavowed with an internal comment like, well, what are they trying to sell me? So how do we reframe? How do we reprogram our reticular activating system to let in what we want to achieve? Natural filters include three things: beliefs, self-image, and goals. So here's a very simple three-step combination to reframe a comfort zone. Visualization. We're looking at coding our radar for what's possible. Visualization reprograms the reticular activating system by programming awareness to create powerful and stimulating internal images. Affirmations. These positive validations of doing and being what you want. The story that frames the visualization. And third, simply to change behavior. New behavior and new experiences create new pathways in the brain. With each repetition, the pathways become more deeply etched. And then finally, when they're well grooved, they become automatic, the default mode, a habit. Your future self lives in your present mind. When clearly visualized, it's just then a matter of actualizing that vision. I want to add one more thing to look at focus. Where you have direct impact, what you can determine, and where you can be effective is your circle of influence. Where you can't be effective, where you can't determine, and that includes everything from the ozone level to how your partner responds, is your circle of concern. So this is something that we inevitably work with clients on, is to help them look clearly at discerning what is their circle of influence, what they can actively determine, and what they can't, their circle of concern, so that they can let go of trying frustratingly to create change in a circle of concern to move that energy to where they can be effective so that they'll be much more effective and experience much more mastery. Engaging a negative or fear-based belief in order to counter it will create what you most try to avoid. The more you keep running away from something, the more you engage it. So the results that we get in our lives are the result of our focus. If we automatically and unconsciously focus on what we don't want, we polarized ourselves to become a magnet for it and to direct ourselves toward it. So the paradox occurs in every aspect of life. What you don't want, you ironically make happen. Focusing on not making mistakes creates mistakes. Focusing on not being late creates lateness. Focusing on not wanting to be financially insolvent creates scarcity. Focusing on not smoking makes you want to smoke. So your mind is an energy field and responds to focus. Whether the focus is negative or positive, the response is to the focus. Your mind precisely and effectively creates what you focus on. And brain research shows that focusing on problems or negative behavior reinforces those problems' behaviors. And additionally, in terms of clients, the harder you push people to change, the harder they'll push back. The best mentoring strategies focus on the present and future, on possibilities and solutions rather than problems. This requires the development of new neural pathways in the brain and learning new thinking patterns. The most important principle is to focus on what you do want rather than what you don't want. So we don't have much time for discussion, but your thoughts and ideas or questions about any of this material? Does this make sense as a kind of a summary and a wrapping up of the principles to move then into looking at application for specific niches?
This is Terry Finney. It makes all kinds of sense. And when I hear this, I think how incredibly difficult it is to get people to make these changes because we're so programmed the other way.
Well, let me offer a couple of things that I've seen work with clients. One is to look at, especially if somebody's in a negative thought loop or looking at a very difficult time in their lives or having something really difficult and challenging going on with family or business, that, and we've touched on this before, but I want to apply it in a way here. We're always asking ourselves questions, and the questions determine what we focus on. So the questions at a time when there's a preoccupation with a family or business struggle is, you know, what's going to go wrong or what's going to be the challenge today? Instead, we always ask ourselves questions from the instant we wake up, even before we're consciously aware of asking them. One thing that I found is really helpful is to recommend to a client to write down three questions that are empowering, that really focus on positive energy. And answering these questions can really put someone in a very positive, empowered state of mind. To write those three questions down, to put them on their nightstand, and when they first wake up, when they first turn on their lamp, before they even get up, to answer those questions and to see what kind of difference it makes. Another is if somebody is really focused in a negative way on something and just can't seem to get beyond it, is to make a to-do and a to-don't list, to really look at being very aware of how this recurring thought or the negative thought loop is a choice to look at the things they do want to think about, a to-do list, the things they don't want to think about, to cue their radars for immediate recognition and to have a to-do list that parallels, that's the follow-up of any to don't, so that when they think of something they don't want to think about, they immediately are able to substitute it for something that they do. Now, these are kind of little gimmicks, but I think the most powerful thing in our work is to really resonate with a client empathically, to let them know that we get how hard it is to change, and then go someplace new, to not leave it at that, but to look at what they want to accomplish and the greater pleasure that they'll have if they accomplish it, and or the greater pain if they don't. And remember, the two greatest motivations that we have is to avoid pain and to seek pleasure. And if there's something that somebody's not doing or not changing, they associate some kind of pain with changing or with doing something. So we need to know with them what is the pain that they're associating with doing it, even though it may not be logical or conscious, so that when they are aware of that, then we can help them look at the greater pain of not doing it and at the greater pleasure of doing it. We can help them reframe. Now, I know this is only a beginning. I know we're out of time. We're over time. So if there are questions about this, let's pick up here next time, because I think this is the central aspect of our work in coaching, and that question that you just asked really captures it. And I think how we address that question, our whole philosophy and systematic plan of doing that is crucial for how effective we are with clients. So let's pick up right here next time.
Great. Thanks.
Okay, absolutely. Thanks very, very much. Have a
great
rest of
the
week. Bye now.
Bye,
see you.